Ave listeners, just a quick message to let you know that we are days away from finishing our Kickstarter campaign for Caesar's Gallic War, a podcast series available to supporters only. So if you want to hear myself and Rhiannon prattle on about Caesar's greatest campaign, wait thee not. Go to kickstarter.com, search for Caesar's Gallic War. There are also links in the show notes and on social media. Thanks to everyone who has supported it thus far. And now... Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. This is Episode CI, The Last Will and Testament of Caesar. As a silence settled over the theatre of Pompey, Rome moved quickly. Will Brutus and Cassius be hailed as liberators and restorers of the Roman Republic? Or will Rome lament the fall of its leader? Much of it comes down to the actions of Antony and the legacy left in the will of Caesar. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The immediate reaction to Caesar's assassination is really divided. There's a lot of confused reaction, but some people are really happy about it. And the best example we've got is Cicero, who immediately on that very day, on the Ides of March, writes a letter to one of the assassins. And this is what it says. It says, "I congratulate you. For myself, I am rejoiced. I love you. I watch over your interests. I desire to be loved by you and to be informed by you of how you are and what is being done."
Okay, so that's somebody who feels maybe a bit left out, but he wants to feel included.
Yeah.
Story of Cicero's life.
It's true, isn't it? He's kind of really happy, but almost wishing that he had been there. And so at least being told about it will make him feel like he's part of it.
Mm.
Well, first person singulars. I do this, I do that. I'm part of the gang.
Mm. Mm. Cicero is kind of demonstrating that there's a real jubilance, at least among the Senate, on the day that this has happened. I'm sure he doesn't speak for the entire Senate. But that's also the impression that we get from the actions of Brutus and Cassius and the other assassins, isn't it? They go through the streets of Rome waving their bloody daggers in the air, essentially.
Yeah, there is this, I mean, what they want to convey is this air of liberation. They're bringing things back to normal so that we've got rid of the tyrant and now we, the Senate, are back in charge. You people are all free. They're assuming pretty much that everybody is going to feel like that, or, you know, most people are going to feel this huge relief that Caesar's gone. To a certain extent, it seems as though they think it can be business as usual and that there will be no repercussions. So it's very easy for us to think with the benefit of hindsight, oh, we know Brutus and Cassius, spoiler, aren't going to do it well out of this. But in fact, that's not what they thought at all in the immediate aftermath.
Mm.
They thought they would be hailed as heroes.
Well, they didn't see themselves as doing an insurrection or assassinating head of state. They saw themselves as repairing the Republic.
So absolutely.
They thought that there was a status quo for them to snap back into after this.
Well, they actually debated, didn't they, whether Caesar was the only person to get rid of.
Mm.
But Brutus was very strong on that they shouldn't kill Antony, that they shouldn't kill anybody else. And that was what won the day. And therefore, there was this idea that you just needed to cut that head off and we'd be back with the good old days.
So Brutus is the one who goes forward to address the people on this day. And why is he pushed forward as the spokesperson?
Presumably it helps that he's got that possible family connection back to the man who got rid of the kings 500 years before. So Brutus the Liberator can be Brutus the Liberator again. And remember that there had been graffiti on statues calling for Brutus to do that. Brutus, where are you now? Written on Caesar's statues. So there were a certain number of the people who were keen for this to happen and were calling on Brutus himself. So he's got that status because of his family connections, or at least his name. And he is clearly somebody who has been close to Caesar. So if he's one of the assassins, as he is, and if he announces himself as such, it's clear that this is depicted as something that had to happen.
And what does he say to the people? What's his argument for doing this act?
Brutus gives a speech that is really, it brings down the tension in the immediate aftermath. It's quite an effective speech. So Plutarch in The Life of Caesar 67 says, "People listened to what was said without expressing resentment at what had been done or appearing to approve of it. They showed, however, by their deep silence, that while they pitied Caesar, they respected Brutus. So it's exactly the kind of response that Brutus would have wanted, because nobody really knows what's going to happen after Caesar dies. And while the liberators think of themselves as liberators, there's a whole lot of doubt. And I think that comes out a bit more clearly in another life of Plutarch, that is the life of Brutus, where in chapter 18, he basically indicates that, you know, they don't know, will there be a riot? Will the people follow liberty as Brutus thinks of it, or will they take up against the assassins? And he says specifically that there was a rabble. He calls them hoi polloi. That's where we get that phrase hoi polloi from, the ordinary people.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You don't know that phrase?
No.
Hoi polloi means the masses. He says there was this rabble and they were mixed up, all kinds of different levels of society, different statuses, and preparing to do violence. So that's real danger. But Brutus brings them right down to quietude. Unfortunately, he tells us in the Brutus that Cinna talks next, and he really wants to rile them up, and that's kind of a mistake. All right, so we're playing against different emotions here. We want, as Brutus wants, and maybe if he'd been left to his own devices, he would have succeeded, to show that there is respect for Caesar, but he'd gone too far, so we had to get rid of him. We don't want this idea that, oh, you know, this is great, we've overthrown a dictator, let's all get up and riot and party, which is what Cinna brings to his own speech, which kind of has the opposite effect.
So who else are moving quickly in this opportunity to make advantage of the void that's left by Caesar?
Well, Antony really has to do something. He also doesn't know what's going to happen next. I mean, he fears for his life. Remember, he's been got out of the way during the assassination.
Yeah.
And as consul, he should now be one of the ones who takes charge. But he, in the immediate aftermath, hides away and gets out in disguise. In the life of Antony, Plutarch says, Antony put on the dress of an ordinary person or a plebeian and hid himself. But when he learnt the conspirators were laying hands upon nobody, but were merely assembled together on the Capitol, he persuaded them to come down by giving them his son as hostage. I think this is a really weird situation. The whole hostage, nobody really comments on it in ancient sources. But this is what you do if you're an enemy making a pact.
Yeah, it's a complete war response, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and look, the immediate aftermath of this is it's a situation where it seems more like they're negotiating. They're trying to keep the peace. So Antony and Lepidus, remember, is also close to Caesar, they try to sort of come to terms with Brutus and Cassius. But the hostage situation seems to me to indicate nobody trusts anybody.
Yeah.
There's a good case here that Antony is the real diplomat who, at least in the short term, manages to keep things fairly neutral and flat. So that he seems to have decided with Lepidus that if there's to be vengeance, it will be later. For the moment, they're going to have the Senate restored and peace restored and try not to have any more killing. He's making himself safe, but he's also making the assassins feel safe.
Yeah.
What we want at this point is negotiation, seems to be Antony's point of view from all of the sources we have. And they do give us slightly conflicting, certainly conflicting emphases, I guess, rather than conflicting evidence. And then the Senate itself also meets and tries to broker peace between the two sides. So that immediate point afterwards, or maybe the second immediate point afterwards, all sides are trying to just bring calm because they know that people could just be inflamed at any moment for either side. Cicero makes this very long speech in Dio. It's an extremely long speech, as things tend to be in Dio. And we get a decree that comes out of it that the assassins will be immune from punishment, which is kind of amazing. And again, with benefit of hindsight, we can see that did not happen. And while Caesar's acts, which people like Cicero were keen to overturn, are passed as decrees, they're going to be kept. Everything that Caesar brought forward, all of his land reforms, that will remain. So that's kind of a way of keeping both sides happy.
And Brutus and Cassius benefit from that.
Absolutely, yeah, because they're not going to be punished.
Yeah, and they get their positions that Caesar gave them.
Yes, and this has an effect on what will happen in the reasonably short term afterwards. Brutus and Cassius, and indeed Decimus, they have provinces to go to, and those commands are now restored, and that means they'll have places to go to if they need to get away from Rome.
Yeah. which will come in quite handy soon.
Yes.
So to seal the deal on this and show that there's no hard feelings over who knifed who, there are a couple of little dinners that happen. So Brutus has dinner with Lepidus, Cassius has dinner with Antony.
It's like they're pairing off.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the worst speed date ever. So we don't have any details from Brutus and Lepidus's meal together, but we do just get this slight little bit of snark from Antony and Cassius's.
Yes. So Dio tells us that Antony said, "Have you perchance a dagger under your arm even now?" There's not complete trust, is there? And Cassius answered, "Yes, and a big one, if you too should desire to make yourself a tyrant."
It's a great line.
We're all treading very carefully. I don't really trust you, Cassius. And Cassius is sort of saying, "Well, I'm prepared to put up with you as long as you don't turn yourself into Caesar."
Yeah.
So they've both got fears on either side.
So now that everybody is friends again.
Well, very uneasy friends.
So now that everyone is friends again, Antony can start to consolidate his position a bit. Now, he's got to be a bit worried about the fact that Decimus has command of a large army and his allies essentially have no formal troops at their disposal.
Well, actually, Lepidus has some troops who are hanging around close to the city as well.
Yeah.
Which is not often mentioned, but they must have exerted some influence. So we might have some kind of power standoff going on, you know. There's a possible armed response from either side. But certainly Antony has to tread carefully. And we've seen he's very good at doing that. But it's not really a surprise that in Shakespeare he turns out to be the one who can manipulate people's moods, because that is how he's kind of depicted in the ancient sources.
Mm.
And he really does get the support of those, according to Plutarch, those who supported Caesar. The friends of Caesar united in support of Antony. And Caesar's wife, Calpurnia, putting confidence in Antony, took most of the treasure from Caesar's house and put it in his charge. It amounted in all to 4,000 talents. That's a whole big fortune.
Yeah, now I looked this up and it's something like a talent is 33 kilos of gold.
Yeah.
Just by itself. So he's got 4,000 of those. So in today's currency, it's more than $60 million that he had. That's just what was given to Antony.
Yeah, that's not his whole fortune.
Yeah. That was just the pocket change that was given to Antony.
And Antony is, he's really lucks out here. I mean, this is not to go to him personally. This is to kind of conduct affairs of state, presumably.
Sure.
But also, he obviously gets enough of Calpurnia's confidence to get Caesar's papers, mm-hmm. including his will. So he's sort of got the archive and the really important piece of paper.
Okay, so let's discuss the last will and testament of Caesar then. This is the document that he'd written up earlier, had given to the Vestal Virgins for safekeeping. Antony's now got this and he holds a reading of it at his own house, and assumably a copy of it will be read out to the people as well, because that's standard practice at the time, Matt says unsurely, waiting for Rhiannon to...
Well, certainly the people get to hear about the bits that are important to them,
there
because some money is left to them.
Okay.
Right, and Antony must know that this will leak to them, even if he's not reading it directly to them.
Yeah.
So this will is read out. Antony doesn't actually get that much in the will. The main person who will benefit is Caesar's great nephew, Octavius. He's also adopted, so he becomes Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus.
Mm.
And that means he's Caesar's heir.
And he gets control of Caesar's finances at that time.
3/4 of his private fortune. And we've seen his private fortune is considerable.
Mm. And he inherits the title.
And we usually call him Octavian until he becomes Augustus, because he is the future Augustus. But in fact, he called himself Caesar from that moment on. We don't do that because it would be confusing, but he's making use of that name instantly.
Yeah. And his guardianship is essentially Antony and Caesar's old allies, isn't it?
Yes.
And they also get named heirs in the second degree, so heir in case something happens to the heir.
Yes, Antony is one of them, and so is Decimus, and that makes Decimus, and by extension the other assassins, look really bad.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that points against them with the people, and a lot of the people of Rome turn against them when they hear about that. Here was somebody that Caesar actually put in his will, left an awful lot of money to, and he's one of the assassins. He's been responsible for killing Caesar. So that looks like,
the worst betrayal.
Yeah, height of ingratitude, you could say.
And there's also an interesting thing about them being the guardian if a male heir is ever born. So Caesar giving himself a bit of wiggle room that he might actually pull off a son.
Clearly he was hoping Octavian is second best, I guess.
Yeah. And the people get something out of it.
They do. And this is really important. Caesar knew how to work the people.
The consummate politician.
Yeah. He leaves them slightly less than they got at his triumph, 300 sesterces per person.
And what does that work out to?
Well, that's about 4 months' wage for a Roman soldier.
That's pretty good.
It is pretty good for nothing, basically.
Yeah, I'd be happy with that. Yeah. Hail Caesar.
And he leaves them his gardens as a public park.
Okay. That's where Cleopatra's staying, so she gets evicted.
Well, she's not going to hang around after Caesar's gone if she's got any sense. But not everybody wanted to give them that money. So Plutarch tells us in the biography of Antony in chapter 16 that the young Caesar came to Rome at this point. That means Octavian.
Yeah.
The young man greeted Antony as his father's friend and reminded him of the monies deposited with him. So he's going straight to the
Where's my 4,000 talents?
For he was under obligation to give every Roman 75 drachmas, which is the same in Greek currency. This is Plutarch, according to the terms of Caesar's will. But Antony, at first, despising him as a mere stripling, told him he was out of his sense and that in his utter lack of good judgment and of friends, he was taking up a crushing burden in the succession of Caesar. So you are not up to the job, he's telling him. And when the young man refused to listen to this and demanded the monies, Antony kept saying and doing many things to insult him. I wish we'd been there for this conversation. For instance, he opposed him in his canvass for a tribuneship. Remember, Octavian is only 19 at this point, so he is kind of getting a bit above himself. And when he attempted to dedicate a golden chair in honour of his father by adoption, i.e. Caesar, according to a decree of the Senate, Antony threatened to hale him off to prison unless he stopped trying to win popular favour. This might not just be Antony trying to get one over Octavian and say, I'm the one who's really in charge as a proper grown-up here, because this whole idea of having a golden chair to honour Caesar, it's the kind of thing that would have happened later when Octavian's firmly in charge. But at this particularly rocky point where we're trying to keep everyone happy and not have the whole city just burst into flames, Antony, you know, he wants to keep down that whole idea that we might be heading for monarchy, that we might be over-honouring Caesar.
Mm.
So he's kind of got to play this in a very careful way, and it might be part of that rather than his power struggle with Octavian that's going on there.
But this really works in Octavian's favour because suddenly Octavian seems to be this person who's defending the people and speaking up for their interests. And, I mean, you know, Cicero even comes on board Team Octavian for this. So, you know, if Cicero's against you, that you're really in trouble, Antony.
Yeah, well, Cicero and Antony clearly always have personality clash, values clash, and this is only going to get worse. I think that because Octavian's only 19, Cicero probably hoped he could shape him.
Mm.
Of course, Octavian, you're quite right, is popular with the people just because he's got that name. Think about how still we often work in, certainly in American politics, dynastic succession is not unknown. And if you've got the Kennedy name, then if you want it, it's an instant path to some kind of magistracy or equivalent.
Now that the will's been resolved, the next logical thing for the city to try and put this all behind them is to have the funeral of Caesar. Brutus and associates do not stick around.
They leave the city.
Probably wise.
Tactful, I think.
Yeah. And it falls to Antony. This is his friend's Roman countryman speech.
Well, yeah, that's Shakespeare's version of it. We have at least two other versions.
Well, Shakespeare should have written the speech for Antony. So what does he actually say? This is a good opportunity for him to address all the people and be memorable. And we've had instances before where there's been big funerary speeches.
We have. Caesar himself was a prime exponent of this. And Caesar really made use of his Aunt Julia's funeral to talk about him being related and her being related to the founder of the Roman race, to Aeneas and Iulus.
Why would Brutus leave this in the hands of Antony then? Because it isn't really sensible for him to let Antony have this platform.
Yeah, this is a big mistake. This is a faux pas on Brutus's part. Plutarch tells us this. He calls it a fatal error of Brutus to allow Antony to organise the funeral. But I guess Antony was very persuasive and he had made it look like he was quite happy to try and balance things out. In fact, he staged the funeral to make the most of Caesar's death. Mm. And perhaps he'd got some tips from his wife Fulvia, who had made the most of her previous husband Clodius's death. Remember, Clodius had been killed by the senatorial faction,
yeah,
Milo. At his death, the people had been so overcome that they'd burnt the Senate house down. You know, this can have a big effect. A funeral can really whip the people up into a frenzy.
So what does he speak about then? We've got details in Appian and a few other places.
We do. We have a version in Appian. We have a much longer version in Dio. They're not the same.
Mm.
They're probably as close to what Antony actually said as Shakespeare's. They do give us an idea that Antony was good at working the crowd and that he started out perhaps tentatively, and when he realized he could get the crowd on his side, he really went for the throat. He really went to play on their pity, get really angry. According to Appian, what Mark Antony does is he starts off saying that he's very humble, that he can't give praise of so great a man as Caesar. Indeed, it should be delivered by the whole country, not just by him. So what he's playing on is you all owe so much to Caesar.
Mm.
He has conquered so much. He has brought so much money into the exchequer. He's been given so many honors by the Senate and the people. Right? He mentions the people in this version of the speech. They all admired his qualities. And so when I speak, this is really clever if he actually said this, I regard the voice I use for speaking as not mine, but yours. Mm. I'm speaking for you.
We've all lost something here.
Exactly. And yeah, we all had something to be grateful for while he was alive. And Appian goes on, he then read them out with a proud and thunderous expression on his face, emphasizing each with his voice and stressing particularly the terms in which they had sanctified him, calling him sacrosanct, inviolate, father of the country, benefactor, leader, as they'd done with nobody else. Mm. So he's saying, you know, you raised him up on this pedestal and now he's being cut off. And Antony apparently was very good at using gesture, which is important for an ancient orator. And he uses the gesture here particularly to gesture towards the body of Caesar every time he, you know, he says father of this country or sacrosanct. I mean, the word inviolate would seem particularly ironic when you could see that this body has been violated,
yeah,
with all of those daggers. As Appian says, comparing the deed with the word. And he then moves on to really mix pity and indignation. So he moves from, you know, you respected and honored him, we have to pity what's happened. The next stage is anger. He tells them that everything that Caesar did was, as he calls it, proof of his mercy, and that whoever took refuge with him remained unharmed, which is not 100% true, but hey, this is the funeral. We don't speak ill of the dead. And the victim is not some other person seeking refuge with him, but the sacrosanct and inviolate Caesar himself, who did not snatch these honors by force like a despot, so contradicting the idea that he was a despot here, indeed not even ask for them. But you, my loyal citizens, by showing him such honor at this moment, although he is no more, are defending us against the accusation of having lost our freedom. So he's basically saying Caesar didn't take your freedom away. He's chipping away at that argument that Brutus had mounted for the assassination. So it's very clever if this is anything like what he said.
This is some brilliant fake news. It's quite a difference from the speech that Brutus gave a few days earlier after the act. So you talked about the stage direction of such an event, and it isn't just the speech that Mark Antony gives. What else is involved in this? It all becomes a bit ritualistic, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, he's using props. Plutarch tells us in Brutus, chapter 19, that he takes the robe of Caesar, all bloody as it was, so what he was wearing when he was assassinated, unfolded it to view and pointed out the many places in which it had been pierced and Caesar had been wounded, which is often how it's staged in the Shakespeare play.
Yeah.
So obviously there, Shakespeare's drawing on Plutarch. And of course, it looks great on stage. That's literally on stage, but it seems as though Mark Antony played it as though he were on stage at the time. Let's see what horrible damage you did to him. Also, we're told that there was a kind of effigy of Caesar there as well, a wax model of him. Suetonius also says in The Life of Caesar that Caesar's clothing was then hung on a pillar on the rostra, and also that there was a golden shrine modeled on the temple of Venus Genetrix, which had been Caesar's temple that he'd built to Venus, which had an ivory couch with gold and purple awnings inside. That's in chapter 84,
yeah.
Which is getting perilously close to that idea of dictatorship and kingship, I have to say.
Throne, yeah.
Yeah. And that there were people employed, as there would be at every funeral, to play music, and in this case, actors and flute players in the procession, who tore their clothes off. Possibly they were instructed to do this. And they burnt them on Caesar's pyre. Caesar's veterans throw their weapons onto the pyre. And we have this pyre kind of ad hoc because the crowd gets really riled up and they loot the local shops for bits of furniture, tables and chairs, that they then build a pyre with in order to burn Caesar there and then. And they take brands from this pyre to burn the assassins' houses, although Suetonius says that they were held back.
But there is fires and buildings burnt down. And
yeah. It's a riot, basically.
Yeah.
And so the funeral turns into something that we would regard as not particularly respectful, but something that commemorates Caesar as, I guess we'd call him a disruptor these days, as what Antony clearly wants him to be. Antony wants him to be this disruptive influence, and he uses the anger he can generate from his funeral in order to do this, which is actually kind of ironic because back in Rome's history, the Brutus who got rid of the kings had done it by bringing out a Roman noblewoman, Lucretia, who had killed herself after being raped by the king's son and used her body to do exactly the same thing, to make the people rise up and want to throw the kings out. So Rome has a history of this, or at least a mythical history of this, and now Antony's using those same forces in order to really rouse the crowd against the assassins.
We're also told about an actor who impersonates Caesar with the great line of, did I save them just so they could destroy me?
Yeah, this is actually a line from a play. So he's quoting from a literary source, a Roman tragedian called Pacuvius, who we only have fragments of. This is a line from a Trojan War narrative. After the Trojan War, Ajax and Odysseus fight over the arms of Achilles. And Ajax says, did I save them so they could destroy me because the judgment is made against him?
Yeah.
And he kills himself. So this now effectively put into the mouth of Caesar, I saved Rome and then they killed me.
Or I saved Brutus and Cassius. I spared their lives.
Exactly.
And they are directly responsible for killing me. Yeah.
Suetonius actually says, and I love this idea, that it's the crowd themselves singing lines from these tragedies. We think of this as high art, but the crowd was versed in it and they knew the ones to pick out which were appropriate for particular situations.
Once the people of Rome have got it all out of their system, there's also some games to celebrate the memory of Caesar that are held by Octavian.
Yes, they're certainly presided over by Octavian, and he is the one who is now going to start milking Caesar's death, quite brutally.
So he starts to use this to his own advantage. So what happens at this point?
Well, usefully, if it did happen, there are a few historians who doubt it, at the funeral games of Caesar. And funeral games are something you would have for a really important person, all right? It is part of the ritual. At these games, a comet is seen in the sky for several nights, night after night. It's often called the Sidus Iulium, which means the Julian star. And this was interpreted as Caesar's soul flying to heaven. It had already been decided that he was a god. He was deified, and this is kind of confirmation. And it's extremely useful propaganda for Octavian, who starts putting it on his coinage. We've seen already in previous episodes how important coinage is, and you make use of the imagery you want to broadcast. So, you know, Octavian has himself on one side, and on the other side he has something resembling a star. So now, of course, he is the son of a god.
Yeah.
And it's great that at this celebration of Caesar's life, we have this kind of astral confirmation of him being a great man and now a god.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Reviews, as always, are appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can also follow myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.